This is an ABC podcast.
This is RN. I'm David Rutledge, and this is the Philosopher's Zone. Welcome to the program and part three of our series, Philosophy in the Wake of Empire, where we're looking at some of the ways in which knowledge in the West has been shaped by colonialism. Well, it's extremely unlikely that Chaka Khan intended her 1978 dance floor anthem, I'm Every Woman, to be taken as a statement of universalist feminism. But there's something in those three words, I'm Every Woman, that puts its finger on something problematic about feminism in the West. And that's what we're talking about today.
I think that what feminism is and kind of has always been is, as bell hooks articulated it in her early work, opposition to sexist oppression. And so there is a universal norm that feminists should embrace, and that's opposition to gender-based oppression. But universal sisterhood, I think, is a lot trickier.
The tricky thing about gender-based oppression is that it takes different forms in different cultures, and what's helpful to women in one part of the world might not be helpful to women in another. But my guest today believes that Western feminism has historically had a tendency to mistake its own particular concerns as the concerns of all women everywhere in the world. Her name is Serene Carter. She's a professor in the philosophy of culture at the City University of New York, and she's the author of Decolonizing Universalism, a Transnational Feminist Ethic. It's a really interesting book, and it explores the ways in which feminism needs to get beyond a certain missionary impulse that positions women in the global South as hopelessly oppressed and needing a good strong dose of Enlightenment liberalism to help them throw off their chains. The implication of colonialism there is no accident. There's plenty of historical evidence to suggest that feminist arguments can be used, indeed they have been used, to advance explicitly imperialist projects.
This goes way back. I think sometimes people think that when we start talking about feminist complicity and imperialism, we're talking about something that, you know, started with the Bush administration or something. But in fact, probably even farther back than this, but in the 19th century, suffragists, for example, were using imperialist arguments. A common example in the UK was that you often saw people claiming that the reason that India and North Africa needed to be colonized was that the men cloistered their women and so therefore could not be trusted to rule themselves. In the States, the National American Women's Suffrage Association actually formed factions over the question of U.S. expansion into Latin America and Asia. And interestingly, you might think that they were doing that because imperialism was a popular cause and they didn't want to distract from suffrage. But in fact, at that time, anti-imperialism or anti-American expansionism was a more popular cause than feminism. So they were really kind of going out of their way in refusing to ally themselves with the anti-imperialist league and actively saying things like that people who can't read, shouldn't be able to vote. But if you want to talk about stuff kind of more recently, we can think about the vast majority of rhetoric about Muslim women that circulates in the West ends up serving imperialist ends. I mean, to give a very clear-cut example, in the early 2000s, the Bush administration in the U.S. justified wars by referring to worries about Muslim women being veiled. Or if you want to think about something even more recent, because I've noticed as I've talked about this book that students think the early 2000s is a very far time away, that in the State of the Union this year, Donald Trump brought up the issue of women being raped at the U.S.-Mexico border. Clearly, we know that he's not a person who's inherently very concerned about sexual assault. It seems much more like what's going on is he's trying to use people's concern about sexual assault to justify further stigmatizing Latinx people and to justify militarizing the border.
Yes, so these are feminist justifications for what you might call imperialist projects. But you're taking it even further than that and talking about the way in which feminism itself, or a certain kind of feminism, you've coined this wonderful phrase, missionary feminism, which is rife with imperialistic and ethnocentric assumptions, as you see it. What are these assumptions? And tell me more about this missionary feminism.
Yeah. So I want to be really clear that I don't think feminism itself has to be missionary feminism. Like, a big part of my goal is to say we can have a feminism that isn't missionary. But you're right. I say that there is this type of feminism that's called missionary feminism that allows feminists to end up becoming agents of imperialism. And I say that, you know, people usually think that what makes feminism complicit in imperialism is that it's universalist or that it's ethnocentric. And part of missionary feminism is ethnocentrism, but there are some other kind of deeper things than ethnocentrism that are going on in missionary feminism that make it what it is. And I say that missionary feminism has these three other features. So one's what I call justice monism, and that's the idea that there's only one way a society could be gender just, right? Like, there's one endpoint of gender justice or of gender equality that would look the same in every society. And I want to say, you don't have to think that, right? Like, you could say, think that there were a lot of ways a society could end up looking without sexist oppression. I also say, and I think this is really important, that missionary feminism is characterized by idealization. And so we idealize something, in Honora O'Neill's words, and which were then kind of later taken up by Charles Mills, when we attribute kind of positive features to it that it doesn't actually have. And I think that a lot of what missionary feminists work with is an idealization of the West and of the history of the West. And the particular kind of narrative about the history of the West that they have in mind is that Western countries eliminated gender inequality, which is already not true, but that they eliminated gender inequality because of their intrinsic moral superiority, and that other countries have failed to eliminate gender inequality because of their backwardness. And part of what is dangerous and missionary about this, or imperialist about this idealization, is that it erases the fact of historical imperialism, right? Like, what has made the West be whatever it is just that it's morally better, not that it colonized the rest of the world. And similarly, what's made the rest, in quotation marks, struggle in various ways is attributed to the intrinsic backwardness of the rest rather than the history of imperialism. There's one other feature of missionary feminism that I identify, which is moralism. Moralism is like the tendency to treat political interventions or projects just like they are attempts to make a moral statement. It's treating global politics like it's just a theater of right and wrong. So one of the things that I think happens in moralism is that moralists don't even think about what the costs of their attempts to help other people might be. So Laila Abulugad famously talks about how the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan overlooked the costs of what war would be effectively, right? Like, all of the conversation was just about, well, women under the Taliban are in such a bad situation, and they were and are, but the conversation could not stretch further to, well, how will they be affected if we bomb them?
Right. So when you criticize this moralizing or this kind of idealization, is part of what you're saying here that we need to decouple notions of women's empowerment, which are always context specific, from more abstract notions of individual freedom or enlightenment values or progressive liberalism, values which may not even be feminist values at all?
Yeah, I think I am saying that we need to decouple feminism from at least a certain type of, like, intense, comprehensive, caricatured liberalism. So, you know, values like the ability to strike out on one's own and kind of reject your family so that you can make money or something, or values like value for divorcing yourself from tradition, these are values that are often invoked when trying to explain why third world cultures are backward. But I'm not actually sure that these values are important for feminism at all. And I think that there are ways in which these values end up undermining feminist goals. So one value that seems like, that I spent a lot of time in the book saying probably isn't a feminist value is the value for something I call independence individualism. And independence individualism is a combination of two things. It's a combination of the idea that only chosen relationships are valuable and the idea that individuals should be, all individuals should be economically self-sufficient. So we often hear that value appealed to when we hear, you know, these narratives that say, oh, like, give microcredit to women in the global south and look, they will leave their husband and that will end their sexism. And we also hear the similar narratives in the West when we think, oh, like making women able to earn an income is going to solve sexist oppression. But here's the reality of it. It is true that in many contexts, giving people an income may enable them to escape an abuser, but it's but that's not even true in every context. But it's definitely not true that that undoes elements of their sexist oppression. It seems like actually this value exacerbates the gender division of labor. So it's not like once women, you know, leave their husbands in the example, they stop being burdened disproportionately with childcare and housework. So this value, I mean, and because the value of independence individualism has written into it that individuals should be economically self-sufficient, it's not going to solve the problem of care work being burdensome and being disproportionately assigned to women. In order to fix that, we need to embrace some kind of value for, like, publicly supporting the work that women do taking care of dependent people.
Okay, so that being the case, and I guess you could give a lot of other examples of ways in which capital F feminism just doesn't always work in the global South and from one culture to the next. Is the implication there that any idea of a feminism with universal norms, you know, this idea of a universal sisterhood is just not going to work because there is a certain imperialist impulse or element that's just hardwired into any universalist project or concept?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to distinguish between universal norms and the idea of a universal sisterhood. So a lot of what I'm defending in the book is that there is a universal norm that feminists should embrace, and that's opposition to gender-based oppression. But universal sisterhood, I think, is a lot trickier. There's an essay from the 90s that I love by Chandra Mohanty that basically talks about how universal sisterhood is a dangerous idea because what it allows is for women in the global north to think that they are on like a level playing field with women in the global south by saying, look, we're all victims of rape, for example. So what we should talk about when we meet and organize is just our shared victimization at the hands of patriarchy. And I think that really misses the fact that Northern women also participate in oppressing other women. So we can't take off the table ways in which women in the North are participating in the oppression of women in the South. Even if we are, we all do share some levels of victimization by patriarchy. We can't just think of women in the North as victims who share victimizations with people in the South.
And we've established that, you know, very simple definition of feminism is that it's opposition to sexist oppression. But do you think that sexist oppression is always the worst thing being faced by women in the global South? Is there a sense in which other forms of oppression can complicate the idea that feminism has to be a first order priority?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question. So I don't, first of all, I don't think we should always have to organize only for the worst thing that's happening to us. But I do think it's true that there are often situations where women who face more than one oppression are having to choose between fighting imperialist oppression, for example, and fighting gender-based oppression. I really like the way that the Australian Aboriginal feminist Eileen Morton Robinson puts this point. She says, and I think this just puts such a nice kind of cap on it, that feminism needn't be the political home for all women all of the time. And I don't think that means that, you know, all women wouldn't benefit from feminist change. I think what it means is that, like, when you're deciding which struggle to fight in kind of the timeline of your life, there might be situations where, you know, fighting the oppression of the settler state is more important, and tragically, sometimes we don't want it to be this way, right? Like part of the point of Crenshaw's concept of intersectionality is that we want to be able to fight multiple oppressions at once. But tragically, sometimes the world happens to be set up so that we have to prioritize one over the other. And I think there are times when it's rational for multiply oppressed women to end up prioritizing one over the other. I also think that a lot of times when women in the North or West think that women in the South have internalized their oppression and that they don't care about gender-based issues, I think what's really going on in many of those cases is that they have other survival-based battles to fight. And it doesn't mean that they don't care about gender-based oppression. It doesn't even mean that gender-based oppression isn't a survival issue. But it does mean that sometimes you can't fight everything at once. And definitely, people are often facing multiple difficult oppressions at the same time.
Yeah, and I guess it can also, in many cases, be even more critical than just a question of priorities. I mean, do you think it's the case that in some contexts, the attempt to realize any feminist ideal at all could be actually harmful or dangerous to women? You know, there are circumstances under which feminism simply isn't a practical option because the risks outweigh the benefits.
Yeah, you know, I think that that's true in, like, hypothetically, I could imagine, I mean, this is me being a philosopher for
yeah.
me, but I'm like, yes, hypothetically, I can, like, imagine a thought experiment like that, but I don't really know of any cases like that. I think one of the things that's really amazing and impressive when you look at global women's movements, instead of focusing on this missionary idea that, like, Westerners need to go out and teach other people how to be feminists, is you notice that women are fighting feminist battles under all kinds of conditions, including like really difficult ones. And yeah, sometimes fighting battles that people in the North or West could learn from.
This is the Philosopher's Zone on RN. You're with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Serene Carter from the City University of New York. We're talking about the residue of colonialism that's sometimes to be found in Western feminism. And just a heads up, you heard Serene mention the Indigenous philosopher Aileen Morton Robinson there. Well, she's coming up on the program in a couple of weeks from now. It's all part of our series on philosophy in the wake of empire. I was following a Facebook discussion a few months ago. It was in response to a news story about how, I can't remember, it was something about how women somewhere in the Middle East were being forced to cover themselves. And a group of concerned white middle-class Australian women on Facebook were horrified by this and saying, you know, we need to do something about this on the grounds that if any women are oppressed, then all women are oppressed. And thinking about that makes me wonder if there are direct moral responsibilities that Western feminists owe to non-Western women. And if that's the case, how can those responsibilities be acted upon without perpetuating all these imperialist assumptions that we're talking about?
Yeah, so first about your example, I just want to say that one of the things that we should be on guard about missionary feminism is like why Western feminists are so often, like, the thing that they care about most is the thing that marks cultural difference, right? So there are various ways in which Muslim women in many contexts are oppressed, just like there's various ways in which Western women in many contexts are oppressed. So, but why is it that this piece of fabric is the only thing that gets Western women as, you know, exercised as they do? But to go to your kind of real question, which is what do women in the West and North owe to other women? I think the number one priority is the one that Alison Jagger kind of defends, which is, what about Western women looking at the ways in which they cause harm to women in the global South? And I don't mean that in a, like, hand-wringing self-criticism way and we sit here and say, oh, it's so problematic that we harm them. I mean, we organize against the harm that we're causing to them. So, for example, like, our international economic order is clearly, you know, harming women in the global South by, for example, like multinational corporations and international trade rules are causing all of this environmental degradation. When your environment is degraded, suddenly women have to walk much farther to get fuel or water, and this increases their work burdens. Or we can talk about how we are creating all of these free trade rules that make it the case that now women are being recruited as sweatshop laborers all over the world, and specifically recruited because you can pay them less than men and they're more docile and they won't unionize. Like, not to mention war, of course, right? Like, I began with talk about the Iraq case and the Afghanistan case. So I think that a first priority really is for people in the North and West to look at ways in which they're causing gender-based oppression to women in the global South, and to try to stop causing the harm and to try to give those women more voice in the global decision-making structures.
Yeah, and there's been so much discussion, hasn't there, over the past, well, since 9/11, I guess. But if we look at Islamic societies, discussion about, you know, specific cultures and traditions that are just intrinsically oppressive to women, you know, quote unquote. And if we look at something like the Salafist tradition, where, you know, it's hard not to see that tradition as oppressive to women, but at the same time, it's a tradition to which many women are deeply committed, and for very good practical reasons. In those cases, is what's needed there to interrogate the idea of what constitutes oppression in the first place? I mean, how do you respond to that kind of thing?
Well, I definitely don't think that being deeply committed to something means that it's not oppressive. I spent the early part of my career kind of working on adaptive preferences, which include cases where people internalize their oppression. So I don't think that that's really what determines whether something is oppressive or not. But at the same time, I spend a lot of time arguing that something could be a tradition and not be oppressive at all. So just to say a little bit about Salafism, because you ask about it. So just in case listeners don't know, and I can't go into a ton of detail about this, but Salafists are a specific strain who happen to believe that we should return to the way of life that existed in the first three generations after the life of Muhammad. And the reason that this movement comes up in my book is that there's this very famous book called Politics of Piety by Sabah Mahmood, where she does an ethnography of these Salafist women in Cairo. And she says, these women have a set of beliefs according to which when something is a command from God, you don't get to question it, right? Like, if something is a command from God, you just have to follow it. Like, if you try to say, do I want to follow it, you're already doing it wrong. And what I want to say kind of in response to that book is, you could believe that you should unquestioningly follow the dictates of God and still be a feminist. You can't do it if you think that God wants sexist oppression, which many Salafists believe. But you could do it if you believed that the unquestionable dictate from God was that men and women were equal. And I think that is, in fact, what many Muslim and Islamic feminists happen to believe. So just to give an example of that, like in Amina Wadud's early work, she kind of explicitly says, you know, what it means to be a Muslim is that I don't get to question anything that's written in the Quran. I just have to follow it. But then she also says, luckily, it's written in the Quran that shirk is one of the worst sins you can commit. And shirk is treating yourself as an equal to God. And then she says, clearly, patriarchy is a form of shirk. It's men treating themselves as though they are equal to God and women as though they're something lower than them. So without saying anything specific about Salafism, which I think happens to often combine the view that women should be oppressed with the view that you should unquestioningly follow the dictates of God, I want to say that it is definitely possible to believe that you should unquestioningly follow the dictates of God and be a feminist. The way that you do that is just by being part of a religious tradition that thinks that God wants gender equality. And there are certainly tons of ways of interpreting Islam that hold that. I am the queen.
I sit on my own throne. We've been talking about, I guess, a negative identification of feminism. You know, feminism is about what it opposes. But is there any room there for advancing a project of celebrating or supporting the notion of women's identity, women as women, or is this something that's always doomed to a certain kind of universalism in the bad sense of the word?
I think that there might be places, especially on the local level, for having feminisms that are grounded in the idea of embracing women's identity. So one of the things I talk about in the book, for example, are some types of, I talk about Nkiru and Nzegwu's work and various arguments for African gender complementarian feminisms. And what these folks often claim that they're doing is they say, look, in pre-colonial Africa, we had a woman's identity that wasn't degraded. Then the colonizers came and gave us their understanding of man and woman, and that understanding had woman's identity always being degraded. So I'd say in the book that I think, you know, there is room for this kind of local project. It may be possible to believe that men and women or various genders should have distinct roles with as long as the roles are don't allow one role to dominate the other. And Nzegwu says kind of specifically that what was built into the society that she's interested in is women having a lot of political power over many spheres of life so that men couldn't veto things that they did and vice versa. And so I talk about that kind of locally in sub-Saharan Africa, even, and of course, within specific societies in sub-Saharan Africa. I think it's important to remember at the same time, though, that in the West, most projects that focus on women's identity first and don't foreground women's oppression have historically ended up taking the identity of the most privileged women and then pretending that that is the universal women's identity, right? So taking the struggles that white upper class cisgender women take to be the struggles of women and then just assuming that those are all women's struggles. So to give a really kind of a really kind of simple example of that, because I know I talked about it really abstractly. You know, there was this fascination in feminism, in white feminism in the States, like until the 60s or so or the 70s, with the idea that, you know, being a housewife had become this part of women's identity that women should attempt to escape. But at the same time, you know, being able to be a housewife has mostly been a luxury only that upper class women have. So saying like we need to focus on our shared identity as housewives and try to get rid of that identity, I think ends up having this very nearsighted and potentially harmful idea of what feminism is. So, yeah, I think there are cases where focusing on identity can be beneficial, especially in local contexts where more liberatory ideas of women's identity have been suppressed. But I also think that in the West, we need to be on guard about the fact that what tends to happen when we do it is that focus on women's identity instead of looking at oppression and that all women face ends up taking one group of women's fight to be every group of women's fight.
Serene Carter, professor in the philosophy of culture at the City University of New York and the author of Decolonizing Universalism, a Transnational Feminist Ethic. And just another name check there, Serene mentioned the Nigerian-born philosopher Nkiru Nzegwu. She too is coming up on the program, and that's going to be next week. We're going to be talking about the legacy of colonialism on African philosophy. So I hope you can join me for that. It's a really interesting conversation. This has been the Philosopher's Zone. You can listen again via the ABC Listen app or any podcasting app. I'm David Rutledge. Tweet me at David P. Zone, and I look forward to your company again next week. Bye for now. But I am not afraid.
Leave me, you old vampire. But I am not afraid. I'm like a burning fire. Leave me, you old vampire.